It's October 14th, 2009, and the first day of Celebration 2009. Welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa, and we'll be your geeks in residence for the next hour. This week, our phone lines are available for your pledges. Please support local programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
You can call 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 toll-free from the neighbor islands. First, we'll look at the latest tech news and happenings in Hawaii and beyond. Then we'll be joined by Jeff Mikulina from the Blue Planet Foundation to talk about the Blue Line project.
We'll then talk to Benny Ron from the University of Hawaii and Glenn Martinez from Olomana Gardens about aquaculture and aquaponics. But first, the headlines.
While most astronomy buffs were fixated on the moon last week with the Friday morning impact of the L-Cross probe, another NASA team was studying a different target. The Messenger spacecraft hit an interplanetary bullseye during its third and final flyby of Mercury, skimming a mere 228 kilometers above the surface of our solar system's innermost planet. Unfortunately, the spacecraft unexpectedly went into a safe mode during the encounter and did not achieve all of its scientific goals, but radio signals received after the spacecraft emerged from behind the planet indicated that the spacecraft is again operating normally.
The primary objective of the flyby was to use Mercury's gravity to alter the craft's trajectory, setting the probe on a course to intercept the planet once more in March 2011 and settling into orbit. But the flyby also produced about 600 images. That's about half of what scientists had anticipated to fill out the picture provided by the first two flybys in January and October of last year. A signal loss just before the closest approach caused the spacecraft to shut down its instruments.
Jeffrey Gillis Davis, a researcher on the Messenger science team, told Bite Marks Cafe that flyby photos confirmed evidence of subsurface magma on Mercury causing non-impact pit craters to form. It's exciting to see this in the photos from Messenger and gives us new clues to Mercury's thermal geologic history. Sean Solomon, principal investigator at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, said in a NASA news release, "As enticing as these flybys have been discovering some of Mercury's secrets, they are the hors d'oeuvres to the mission's main course, which is observing Mercury from orbit for an entire year." So it's interesting that this satellite is circling Mercury and the sun and actually decelerating so that in 2011, it'll actually go into orbit around Mercury.
And this has been a heck of a journey for this particular spacecraft, 4.9 billion miles so far, and it's only three quarters of the way done to getting to where it needs to be. But, you know, 90% of Mercury had already been imaged. They were really hoping to kind of close that gap with this. It's kind of a pity with the glitch that they had, but presumably when it does settle into orbit, they'll be able to get all of the images that they need.
Well, you know, when I was talking to Jeff and he was explaining to me what actually happened, it evidently there's two power supplies, and when it went into the sort of the back end of Mercury, it thought that the primary power source was not sufficiently powered to power the satellite, and actually went to transfer it over to the secondary power supply. And then at that point in time, the actual plan for photographing was changed into the safe mode.
Right,
and by the time they came around Mercury and realized that it wasn't in its primary mode, it took too long really to get it back into the primary operating mode. So, you know, it was already like hundreds of thousands of miles away.
But it's definitely been a busy week for our astronomers here.
Yeah, definitely.
In other astronomy news, we've got some good news and some bad news from the summit of Mauna Kea. Now, back in July, we reported on efforts to track an 1,100-foot-long asteroid named Apophis, which at the time was said to have a 1 in 45,000 chance of colliding with Earth in the year 2036. Well, thanks to greatly refined observations by UH asteroid hunter Dr. David Tholen and his colleagues at Arizona and Puerto Rico, that probability has been reduced to about 1 in 250,000, but it will still be a very close encounter.
Dr. Tholen said in a statement, "Our new orbit solution shows that Apophis will miss Earth's surface in 2036 by a scant 22,000 miles, give or take 125 miles. That's slightly closer to Earth than most of our communications and weather satellites." The bad news, the revised orbit calculations reveal that Apophis will be making another approach to Earth three decades later in the year 2068. The asteroid is currently on the other side of the sun, But when it reemerges next year, astronomers will ramp up observations and calculations even more.
Now, Dr. Tolan was part of a three-member team that first discovered Apophis in 2004. That asteroid made headlines a few months later when the earliest calculations were of a 1 in 37 chance of hitting Earth in the year 2029, on Friday the 13th, no less. Fortunately, astronomers are confident that the 2029 approach will not bring a catastrophic collision, and the newly calculated approach in 2036 should also not end in an impact, but astronomers don't know yet how its first pass will affect its trajectory.
So in 2068, do we need to really worry, or you know, how are they going to come about with their prediction on the, you know, probability for impact?
Well, you know, you're talking about rocket science. It's very complex math. And the problem is that that first pass in 2029 could change everything. You know, they're saying that even just the effect of this of solar energy radiating out of the sun can affect where it goes, and also the spin of it, and, you know, how it's affected by other asteroids. So what is what at that point, just a 460-mile sort of variance, 10 years later can be 18 million miles variance. So it's a big piece of space out there that they're going to have to figure it out. But hopefully, well, maybe by 2036 or 2060, we're all going to be living on another planet.
Well, you know, 2036, well, for it to come at 20,000 miles, that's still 2,000 miles below the communication satellites, because at geosynchronous, they're at 22,000 miles.
Right, closer than the moon.
So I'm hoping it doesn't, you know, collide with one of the satellites.
Well, what I think is interesting is that first pass is on Friday the 13th, and the second pass, the one that now we're worried about, is Easter Sunday. So someone's trying to send us a message, maybe.
Well, next up, virtual organizations and online collaborations are becoming commonplace, but relatively little is known about what makes them work and why they might fail. Now, two University of Hawaii professors have jointly received a $382,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to study how online professional communities function. The awardees are speech professor Devin Rossin and Dan Suthers, a professor of information and computer science. Rossin's research specializes in social networks and culture. Suthers, meanwhile, also serves as the director of the Laboratory for Interactive Learning Technologies, which develops software for group collaboration and course management.
The professors were awarded the 3-year competitive grant for their proposal to develop what they're calling the TRACES framework. It's a 3-part solution, which includes an analytic framework, a common data model, and software tools. With such a framework, researchers would be better able to track the movement and changes in participants, ideas, and artifacts in a group.
Rossin and Suthers will focus specifically on social networks that support PhD students, as well as K-12 educators, including those that work with rural and other underrepresented students. Ultimately, they hope to improve the infrastructure that supports virtual learning organizations. The grant begins next month. It was funded through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and administered by the National Science Foundation's Office of Cyber Infrastructure. Now, Dan Suthers, he's been involved with social networks for a while, and he put together something called the Hawaii Networked Learning Communities, which is actually still an active sort of online community.
Well, actually, you know, that group that he works with, they develop a software called Prometheus, and I think a lot of students at UH now are familiar with it. Instead of WebCT, it's one of the ways that you take classes online, and they've been very busy. In fact, they had just kind of rewritten the software and using Ajax and Ruby on Rails, a lot of the new sexier programming languages that we've talked about here on the show. And as for Rossin, I remember him because he was actually interviewed on MSNBC and some other programs, because he did a study earlier about a correlation between people who watch reality TV shows and who are promiscuous in their friending on social networks, sort of kind of saying that people who believe in the celebrity of the individual kind of live these things out when they get online or get onto Facebook.
I'm definitely going to have to follow these guys and see the results of their studies and maybe report that on Bite-Mark Cafe.
Absolutely. A 4-square-mile patch of Maui's southern coast will be home to a new kind of power grid, one that saves energy by turning off household appliances when electricity is expensive and makes better use of wind and solar power. General Electric recently announced it would test its smart grid technology in the luxury resort community of Wailea, hoping to reduce peak electricity consumption there by 15% by 2012. Planners envision installing a new kind of power meter in homes, a wall-based unit that can monitor how much electricity is being used by various appliances and turn them off when it's most expensive. The project also would upgrade the utility's computer systems so that it can integrate more renewable energy.
There are about 70 smart grid pilots nationwide, including Miami, Seattle, Houston, and Boulder, Colorado. But Wailea is one of the only resort communities where the test is being conducted. Bob Gilligan, Vice President for Transmission at GE Energy, said there's a lot of opportunities for us to improve our knowledge of what's using power and making it easier for us to shut off power when we're not around. Most of the consumers aren't really aware of how much energy they're using at any time of the day.
The smart grid would help integrate additional clean energy into the grid through computers that could quickly manage Maui's power needs, adding and subtracting alternative power sources when desired. Half of the $14 million Maui project is paid for with a federal Department of Energy grant, with the rest of the resources and personnel contributed by General Electric and Hawaiian Electric. The pilot is being treated as part of the federal economic recovery package, which includes $4.5 billion for smart grid development.
Yeah, that's interesting that they would test this out in Wailea, which is kind of a controlled environment. But I would think there's some other, let's say communities that they could probably test this technology.
Yeah, I think it's mostly that it's being developed quickly. It's also, I would say, a higher, income neighborhood where you wouldn't mind paying a little extra for these different technologies to be in your home. But, the Maui grid in total has about 200 megawatts, 30 megawatts now coming from wind farms. And so being able to have the utility work with your house to manage electricity is definitely a good idea.
Finally, the latest winners of the Governor Linda Lingle Innovation Awards have been announced. The three recipients are an elementary school student coordinator, the University of Hawaii at Hilo, and a company developing a system to harvest deep ocean water. The Individual Innovation Award went to Tom Yamamoto and Iliahi Elementary School in Wahiwa. He developed the Iliahi Dragon Cafe, which links elementary schools and Lelehua High School. The high school students operate the cafe, selling coffee, tea, and hot chocolate. Meanwhile, fourth and fifth grade students track attendance, tally sales, and balance income and expenses.
The younger students enhance their math, communications, and money management skills, and the high school students earn an elective credit toward graduation as well as build a college scholarship program. The government award went to UH Hilo for its response to growing enrollment despite shrinking budgets. Arts and Sciences Dean Dr. Randy Hirokawa and Housing Director Miles Nagata worked together to convert the dormitory dining room into additional teaching space during the day.
And the organization award went to Deep Ocean Hawaii, which is working on providing clean drinking water to populated centers worldwide. The company uses a reverse osmosis process to separate deep ocean water into potable and brine products. In the event of a disaster or water shortage anywhere in the world, the company can produce and ship desalinated drinking water. Meanwhile, the company can produce and ship deep ocean brine in bulk as a commercial ingredient. The brine is used in large refrigeration installations and food preservation. So it's interesting that I was looking on the web and they have this vessel that's actually out, in fairly deep water, pumping the water up into the vessel and then doing the desalination there.
Right. And actually, they see a lot of applications for this from the food and beverage industry to, as we mentioned, the refrigeration and sort of bulk food kind of processing. But they're located out at the Natural Energy Lab on the Big Island. So there's a number of people, as we've even discussed on our show, working with deep ocean water, whether it's a company that's just selling it as a boutique kind of expensive water, or because in this case they're saying, this is water that hasn't necessarily been contaminated by human activity. It's a very kind of pure water. They even sell it just as is, and they kind of innovated the way to ship it in a container, the same kind of containers you see on the back of a truck, but it's full of this deep ocean water.
Yeah, it's interesting work. And I think, of course, there's other applications for deep ocean water, which we've talked on our show, too, about using it for the air cooling of buildings in downtown Honolulu.
Now, I definitely do want to mention also the UH Hilo project, because I'm a proud former student of UH Hilo. And, the Halekahau dormitory cafeteria, yeah, definitely was not being used during the day while everyone's on the other part of the campus. Why not use that for classrooms? So this dean, who was also teaching a communications class, said that's what they should do. They also kind of gave a shout out to their communications specialist, Bob Chi, who refurbished old computers and got them in place. So they didn't have to buy anything either to do that innovation.
Great. And that's it for the news. Now joining us tonight in the studio is Jeff Mikulina from Blue Planet Foundation, and he's here to tell us about the Blue Line Project. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, Bert. Thanks for having us on.
Now you've been... I know, busy doing a lot of different sort of projects with Blue Planet Foundation. But the Blue Line project obviously has a blue line involved, but there's much more to it than that, right? Tell us a little bit about the Blue Line project.
Well, we're really excited about this project to engage Hawaii's youth in drawing the line on climate change. And literally, that's what we'll be doing. Using Dr. Chip Fletcher at UH's, his map that he developed, we'll be drawing the 1 meter sea level rise, or the effects of a 1 meter sea level rise on our islands. And it'll be mostly younger youth doing this, students, high school students, middle school students, statewide, 20 different locations on October 24th. And the idea is to send a message to global leaders as they prepare for the Copenhagen meeting in December, where they'll be hammering out a new agreement on greenhouse gas emissions. Send this message from Hawaii's youth saying, please act, please get our emissions down to 350 parts per million, because this is the future that we face here in the islands, not just Hawaii, but vulnerable islands globally.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned 350, and there's an organization called 350.org. What is the tie-in there? And you referred to, you know, carbon dioxide and parts per million. What does that all stand for?
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting about this is we've been monitoring this right here at home on top of Mauna Loa. They've been taking a sample of air every 10 minutes and seeing the composition of carbon dioxide in it. And since they've been measuring, we're up to about 390 parts per million. Scientists are telling us we really need to get down to 350 parts per million if we hope to, as Dr. James Hansen of the NASA Goddard Flight Center says, if we hope to have a planet similar to the one that civilization developed on. Remember, before industrial times, we were about 275 parts per million. And by the way, last time we were at 400 parts per million, the ocean was about 8 to 40 meters higher than it currently is. So dramatically different planet. You talked about Mercury earlier. We're heading towards Venus if we keep this up. So 350.org is an international group. They're selecting October 24th as their day of action. And the whole idea is to try to get this number 350 ingrained in people's minds so we know the target that we're all acting toward.
So I want to get back to the line that we're going to be drawing. Apparently this was inspired by a project that actually tried to get going on the mainland, but they weren't able to get their line drawn. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was interesting. Yeah, in California, some activists were saying, hey, let's paint a 1 meter sea level rise as a daily reminder of what climate change could do. But apparently some real estate folks were a little concerned about the implications of saying, hey, the real estate Makaya, this line might not be worth so much.
So, well, it's sort of the same way people kind of argue about the lava hazard lines on the Big Island, for example. But so is there just going to be chalk or people dispersed all over Honolulu drawing on the sidewalk?
Pretty much. I mean, that's the idea. We're going to be using blue chalk. This is calcium carbonate. It's a natural substance. Don't worry. But we'll have about 2,000 students so far registered, 25 different schools statewide, again, 20 different locations. And it won't just be a line. We're asking them to do art or to do write a slogan. We're having a creativity contest. And what's going to be fun about this is on our website, blueline project.org, the students will be able to directly upload the photos they take that morning of their art, of their slogan or their solution that they do along that 1 meter sea level rise. And then we're going to have a creativity contest. So anyone globally can see what's happening at different locations in Hawaii at this 1 meter mark.
So on the 24th, will we be actually seeing students out there in specific areas sort of drawing that line?
Exactly. Well, yeah, statewide. So drive safe, look out for or bike safe, whatever you're doing. We'll be in Waikiki, Kapaa, Hanalei, Hilo, Kona.
Are you and in terms of determining where the 1 meter line would be, you're basically looking at the elevation and sort of remapping it based on where the water line would be given a 1 meter rise. Now, I was looking at the map that you have on the website, and fortunate for Hawaii Public Radio, it doesn't quite reach the front door, but it does seem to kind of enter into the parking lot over at Don Quixote. So. Mm.
But you know we're in the basement here. So
yeah, I was wondering about that.
So we left that up to the experts at UH, and Chip is very careful to say this is the extent of flooding. So it might not just be based on elevation. It's due to topography and some streams that might not otherwise drain into the ocean. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of our places like Waikiki, I mean, this was built on a wetland, Kailua. So you could see flooding really quickly if we start to see an increase in sea level.
I mean, this is remarkable stuff. You mentioned Chip Fletcher a couple of times. He's the coastal geologist that developed these maps. So if you go to that website, you can actually see video animations of the water level rising, and all of a sudden Waikiki turns into like Venice with, you know, waters in the street, and, you know, the Alawai Golf Course is not a golf course anymore. So it's definitely kind of an eye-opening experience. Have you worked with any property owners, or is there a kind of outreach at that point where someone says, well, I'm going to be coming down your street with a blue line?
You know, we're not there yet. And we'll be, you know, sticking with public locations doing this. And we think there'll be acceptance. I mean, when you see students out there, this is an important message. But we really haven't gotten to that level yet. I think this is still far enough in the future where people haven't fully accepted that this is coming. This is happening. We're going to have to redraw the maps of Hawaii.
But if you want to get the attention of some of the delegates that are going to Copenhagen in December, what is it that you want them, or let's say people, to focus on the 24th, so that this message can actually get out there to others that are, you know, in these European delegations and making some decisions that perhaps will impact, you know, what we do?
Yeah, and it's a challenge. You mentioned the European delegation, and that's really not one we have to worry about. It seems like they have set 350 as their target, and they're doing a lot of emissions reduction themselves. Same with some other developed countries. But there are different constituencies out there that we want to focus on, particularly those that are kind of our allies in terms of island nations or and developing nations across Asia. I just think it's important. We have to do what we can here in Hawaii to say, look, we're highly vulnerable. Places that people know and love, like Waikiki, are going to be fundamentally different unless we take serious action. So we think we have an obligation from Hawaii's youth saying this could happen in our lifetimes.
Well, I think definitely Hawaii has a lot in common with some of these other nations. We've had on as a guest on our show a couple of times a woman named Roz Savage, and she's been rowing solo across the Pacific Ocean to raise awareness of these issues. And she landed in Tarawa, which is an island nation that most of it would be gone if we have these kind of sea level rises. And she's actually going to be in Copenhagen as well. So certainly this is, I think, something people need to pay attention to. So where can someone get more information? How much more involvement are you looking for?
Everyone. Everyone's welcome to join us. Again, we have about 2,000 students, but if you can come, this will be October 24th, starting about 10 a.m. It's probably only going to be an hour or two, so it's easy to fit in, bring the family down. Go to our website, blueline project.org, and you can find out the locations. There'll be a little command center. We'll have giveaways and things like that and try to make it fun for everyone.
Okay. Right. Thanks, Jeff, for joining us.
Thank you, Bert. Thanks, guys.
And after a short break, we'll return with Benny Ron and Glenn Martinez to talk about aquaculture and aquaponics.
Please, if you enjoy local programming on Hawaii Public Radio and shows like Bite Marks Cafe, please call us at 941-3689 or from the neighbor islands at 877-941-3689. You know, in these times, the local information, local programming is, I think, very important. And certainly that's a message that we want to share with you. Let's turn things over to Beth and Kozovich in Pledge Central.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. And as you just heard from our fantastic executive producer, Beth Ann Kozlovich, and our good friend, Ian Kitajima, we're in our first day of Celebration 2009. We want to get it off to a great start. Our phone lines are reserved for your pledges. So to make yours, please call 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689. From the neighbor islands.
And tonight we're talking to Benny Ron from the University of Hawaii and Glenn Martinez from Olomana Gardens about aquaculture and aquaponics. Aquaculture as a technology has been around for a while, but the university has recently selected Benny Ron to lead the program. Benny, can you tell us a little bit about what entails this aquaculture program and what departments are kind of actually involved with it?
Basically, the whole university system is involved in it. And the fact that they decided to put this position in the office of the Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education means a lot. It means that the university sees it as a mission, knowing and understanding that the fisheries around the world is in decline and the future should be and will have to be in aquaculture. The university decided to put all the weight on that. and they hired me especially to fill up this kind of position. And there are so many people at the university system working on aquaculture in different departments, in different schools, in different islands, and they wanted somebody to pull all the forces together to be stronger and to be more focused, and this way to bring about a higher level of research and to reach the community and the farmers.
Well, you're at the university. There's this new focus and attention on aquaculture. But Benny, you're doing it. I mean, it's your business. It's also your passion. Can you kind of introduce us basically to what aquaponics is, the history of it, and how you came to it?
Well, Glenn, with Olomana Gardens, and you're the actual hands-on guy that's developing this thing called aquaponics. Glenn, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing?
We work with the University of Hawaii, the Outreach College, and that's teaching non-credit courses. And people come out on Saturdays and Sundays, and little courses are like $20 to $50 a pop. They come out anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, and they learn hands-on the different options. And I'm kind of concentrating on the backyard guy, the person that wants to get in there, get their feet wet, and want to get an introduction to it. It's really great. I mean, raising tropical fish has been a long time hobby in America. The technology we're doing, it's only about 4,000 years old. The Chinese really got down using fish and what they call fertigation, using the fish water to irrigate the crops. All we're doing now is taking it and put it in a suburbia or urban backyard. And they call it urban aquaponics. There's books out by that name. And that's where you have like something the size of a hot tub with fish in it, grow them, take the water, pump it over. You only have one small pump, and it pumps it over to your vegetables. The vegetables clean up the water, eat up all the pollutants, which in my case are nutrition, and they nutrify. That we call it nutrifying bacteria, and it cleans it all up, and the water goes right back to the fish. So this system uses less water than any other known form of gardening. And that. So it's a win-win situation. You get your vegetables and you get your protein from your fish.
So, you know, we have kind of two subjects here. One is aquaculture, which, Benny, you're heavily involved in from a university standpoint, from the academic side of things. And Glenn, aquaponics, which is more the actual integration of this sort of raising fish and using that fish water to water the plants. How did you guys kind of hook up? I mean, what's the common element that got you guys to sort of work together?
I tell you, what's happening now is that although we know that aquaculture is very important, and we know that food security to Hawaii is majorly important. You know, we are stranded on islands that basically if we cut off transportation, we are in big trouble. And this is also related to food safety. And we know that U.S., 80% of the seafood is coming from outside, and more so in Hawaii. So we need to take care of that. And it seems that because it's a university, it's like you think right away, like you said, academics. But we have to realize that the real thing, eventually, the end customer is the farmers. The farmers are the one giving us life. All of us, we live. Without the farmers, we don't have life. And when it comes to aquaculture is the kind of profession that eventually it has to be practical. Eventually, all the education system and all the supporting efforts should eventually go to the farmers so they can actually do the work and produce whatever needed. So when I start looking around at the whole program, I noticed that one of the problems, especially with the economic situation that we have now, that the state have to cut a lot of the manpower, and we don't have so much extension agents as we used to have or should have. And the aquaculture development program was cut off. Out of 8 people, 6 of them will have to go home. And this is really terrible for the aquaculture support team for the farmers. So when I start talking to people and I met Glenn Martinez, it was great because I realized that many of the agents, the extension agents, are within the farmers. And Glenn is doing a great job going around and helping other farmers. So we got a bonding, I would say, because I saw that's a great opportunity to that farmers will work with farmers. And together with Glenn, eventually we organized, for example, this bus tour, aquaponic bus tour on the Big Island. We went together for 3 days, and Glenn and his team, Natalie, organized a wonderful bus tour we went on. Many farmers came with us, other extension agents, people from NOAA, and then we went from farm to farm for 3 days, and we were sharing with everybody the information, and we saw so many wonderful things. And I think Glenn is keep doing this kind of great job, and I think we learn that farmers can help farmers.
So, Glenn, when you're going on these tours, I mean, you mentioned the technology is 4,000 years old, but for a lot of people, I think it's a new thing, this combination of fish raising and hydroponics, which is, I guess, just growing plants in water specifically. So now there are people here in Hawaii, there are more and more people trying to get into it. Are you seeing a lot of innovation, or are you? What are some of the practices that people have developed right here in Hawaii?
Well, right here in Hawaii, we're halfway between Dr. Rikosi from the Virgin Island Institute in Florida, who's the great-grandfather of all of this, okay? Mm. He is, if you go track everybody's history, their knowledge comes from Dr. Rikosi, kind of the number one guy. You could jump all the way over to Australia. Australia heard about Dr. Rikosi, and from some of her students, they started mimicking. Australia's got a terrible, terrible drought problem, so they're very conscious of anything that will save water. So Australia in the last 6 to 8 years has really taken off and really led the charge on this urban aquaponics. Well, here I am with a foot on each shore, you know, one in Florida. I'm a Florida boy, and that's my native state. And in Australia, I married an Australian lady, and I popped down there. I'm into permaculture from Australia, and I kind of like the guys, a real entrepreneurial spirit. Well, we come back to here, a fellow named Tim Mann from Friendly Aquaponics. He attended a Dr. Rikosi course, and about a year ago, he taught a class, hoping 6 to 8 people would show up. 70 people showed up. Wow, quite a groundswell. Well, we all took the course. We all went home. For 6 months, we didn't talk to each other. And then slowly, little forums started up. Like Ben has got the Aquaculture Hub forum up. Some of my students from my little backyard thing that I'm teaching, they got a little forum. We started talking, and then we started visiting each other. And then with Benny's encouragement, I started putting tours together through it. And we started getting 10 to 16 people to get in a van and go from farm to farm. We're talking like 4 farms a day for 2 to 3 days in a row. It's exhausting. But what we saw, each one of us was reinventing the wheel, coming up with new technologies. And some of the breakthroughs we got is the nursery beds that flood the water from the bottom and not from the top, drills that go in and cut a 3-inch hole, then down to a 2-inch hole. So we flip the phloem over that floats in the water. The roots have much better access to the water. And we saw that people, and I went down to Australia and I learned how to do these clay balls and what they call a cinder beds. And the water flushes up and it flushes down. And I converted that and used the Big Island cinder. Now we're coming online. We're certified organic. Our stuff sells like hotcakes. It's doing great. And fish, the big breakthrough is there's no E. coli. So with all the E. coli scares going all over the country, guys like me who are organic are looking for a safe fertilizer. And it's fish fertilizer. So I can feed my fish and use that fish poop water, you know, effluent, immediately to fertilize my plants. And I have no concerns about diseases. So this is a big breakthrough because, folks, come on. If we have a dock strike and we don't get food shipped in here, you think they're going to ship in fertilizer? The farms are going to collapse. Anything that's depending on continuous supply of petro fertilizer. When it went up to $5 a gallon, the hydroponic schools shut down. Even the Oahu Boys Prison, they shut down their hydroponic. The chemicals got too expensive. But fish food, wow, you can feed them a Zola. You know, you can. There's so many different ways to feed your fish.
So, Glenn, you know, when you talk about aquaponics, is the output of aquaponics mostly the vegetables that get fertilized? Or are there, you know, aquaponics that are actually doing a lot for, you know, raising fish?
Well, when you raise your fish, let's say you have a 300-gallon tank. You would have 100 fish in there, a 3-to-1 ratio. With that 3-to-1 ratio, you can raise 2 square feet of garden for every gallon of water. So a 300-gallon tank, which is a big horse trough, that will give you 600 square feet of very, very high intensive gardening, okay? And so you're doing aeroponics, you're doing aquaponics, you know, or you're bordering on hydroponics, you're just using fish water instead of chemicals. So 600 square feet, the beautiful thing, all the authorities that write these garden books and that agreed that a 10 by 10 foot square area will supply each member of your family with all the vegetables they need. So if you have 600 square feet, that's a family of six can eat from the fish in a 300-gallon tank. So it's a win-win situation. A lot of people who you would think, oh, you ought to have a vegetable garden, a lot of guys don't get into that. But if you can throw a fish tank in there where you got something you can go out and kill it, you know? No, but you get to raise it. They become great pets, and they self-breed. You don't have to go out and buy your stock. You don't have to buy your seed every time. So here you got, put in a 300-gallon tank, you can eat 2 to 4 fish every week and go on forever. It's a self-perpetuating garden. Yeah.
Well, Benny, you spoke about, you know, kind of food security issues, and that mm-hmm. definitely goes to what Glenn's mm-hmm. talking about as well. I'm kind of curious, you know, how small of an operation can hydroponics entail? I mean, is it if you've got a small backyard, then hydroponics is something you can get into, or do you need what I would consider to be more of like a farm-sized lot?
I think that the nice thing about aquaponics is you can tailor it to any size. If you want to have it in your kitchen, I have it in my office. I'm using it, moving the water to my plants in my office. So you can do it anywhere. If you talk about the Jim Ricosi's system, by the way, Jim Ricosi, Dr. Ricosi from the Virgin Island, who works on it for about 30 years. I flew him over in July, and he gave here 6 lectures. I took him around. He worked hard for us. And we took him to UH Hilo also to give lectures to the farmers. And I went with him around so he can look at farms and give advice. And we got such a wonderful time together, and his knowledge is amazing, this is a news station, right? So I can tell you that I'm planning to bring him in July and have one big international aquaponics conference, and we're going to jump around from one island to another to see. In his systems, these are big systems, commercial systems, he has annually, he can get 5 metric ton of tilapia, 580 kilo every 6 weeks. And he has the stocking rate, he has, you know, Nile tilapia is 77 fish per metric cubic, you know, it's a meter by meter by meter. And he get out of his, you know, leaf lettuce, he get 1,404 cases annually with 24 to 30 heads per case, 27 cases per week. He has 5 metric tons of basil annually, and 2.9 metric ton annually okra. And this is only from this fish that he's selling. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to make it really small, you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that mm-hmm. case that you just described, he's raising tilapia to
mm-hmm. Exactly, Nile tilapia.
Now, of course, when you look at various aquaponics kinds of setup, and of course, the one that's in your office is probably not tilapia, right? I mean, you probably
right.
got tilapia. Some smaller fish. Are there, you know, in terms of Glenn, you know, the implementation that you've seen, are they pretty much all using tilapia, or does it vary?
When you get down to Kona and you get to your high-end customer, they're sitting in a very beautiful home overlooking the Kona coast. It's koi fish. Mm-hmm. They got koi fish pond. Now, the biggest problem koi fish guys have is filtering that water. You got to change out the water 25 to 30% every week. You got to throw it away. People are curious where you're throwing it away. Then you got to buy good potable water to put in there. Oh, you got to dechlorinate it before you put it in there. It gets to be a logistic hassle. Mm-hmm. So then you start buying biofilters and that. And your wife starts looking at you like you're a train nut getting carried away. You're getting into the tinker toys of all this stuff. And it's starting to look like a hardware store in the garage, right? And then along comes a fellow who says, you know, you could take a 2-inch pipe, take it out of your koi fish, very small pump, run it to the backyard. Mama could grow all the vegetables she wants on waist-level high tables, no stooping, no bending. As soon as you get off the ground, you get away from all your crawly bugs. For every foot up, you get rid of about 30% of your bugs. The only bugs left are the ones that fly in. They're like the little white moth, the little caterpillar guys, the things that sting. Very minor compared to what's crawling on the ground. oh, you don't have dirt per se, so you don't have all the dirt bacteria problems that you normally have with the soil pests. You're up on Black Island cinder. You're planting waste level high. You're not going to use any water. You're using Papa's water from the koi fish up in the front yard. It looks a beautiful display, right? Koi fish are tickled pink. The water goes into the backyard, and an hour later it comes to the front yard, and it runs 24 hours a day, cheaper than any other filtering going. So all of a sudden the wife becomes much more understanding about this little koi fish hobby you have.
Now, one of the things that you had mentioned earlier, you know, certainly food security is an issue, but you're talking about more high-end now. People are getting into koi farming, mm-hmm. for example. One of the other catchphrases that you had mentioned was organic. Now, from what I understand, you know, the traditional, what I think of when I think of hydroponics, you know, plants mm-hmm. growing in just water, that cannot be organic. So is this, you know, is what your practice, how does that make it organic?
Okay. The fish, there are no fish, organic fish in America that I know of. Okay. The problem is, what are we feeding them? You're feeding them the leftovers from the fishing industry and that. Now, there have been big breakthroughs. We got our fish food now is about 95% vegetarian going to the fish. They're getting the fish. They're breeding them over to a vegetarian diet. So that's good. But think about this. When you go to Whole Foods stores or you go to The Source or all the other organic stores where you buy organic food, what kind of people are in there? Any red meat eaters in there? They tend to be a bunch of vegetarians and vegans. So when I introduce them to aquaponics, they go, do I have to eat the tilapia? You go, no, you can raise koi fish, you can raise tropical fish, catfish, anything. You don't have to eat them. All you want is the fish poop. Now the fish poop comes out, you get the manure, you got the dirty water, you pump it over to the plants, there's no disease there. The plants just suck it up. Come back to your American history. What did the Indians teach us, the pilgrims, to do? Put a fish underneath the corn plant. That was the big breakthrough. That got them invited to Thanksgiving. Huh? Right? I mean, that's what it was. That's simple, right? But that was the natural thing, to put the fish underneath the plant when you planted it, and it gave it the fertilization. And that was the big breakthrough. So all we're doing is taking that football and running with it. But I have a lot of clients and a lot of people, they're not going to kill any living animal. They don't eat anything with a face, you know, kind of folks. So we give it the best of both worlds.
You know, that the description of the koi pond, I'm you know, we're actually pretty close to the Pagoda Hotel just around the corner, and they have a pretty extensive koi pond, and I noticed that they clean it pretty much every other day, or it's pretty frequently. And you know, you bring up a good point. I mean, all that water that they are sort of cleaning and recycling, you know, could go to growing some vegetables.
Yep.
But you know, Benny, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about aquaculture, because you know, aquaculture in the Hawaiian culture has been something, you know, with fish ponds and, you know, growing it from a traditional standpoint. But, you know, the aquaculture business in Hawaii spans a wide range of kinds of resources. I mean, from shrimp to saltwater fish to freshwater. I mean, what do you see your focus on, and what do you see being the bigger money makers, I guess, in the aquaculture business?
Well, I don't think that the main idea is just to bring the money. I don't think, the main issue for Hawaii as a culture. And so you were talking about the way the Hawaiians used to grow the fish in the fish ponds. And when the Hawaiians were here, before we got all the, you know, the British came in and all that, and all of us here from all over the world, the Hawaiians were self-sufficient. They didn't have medicine and all those shipments coming in every day. And somehow they survived, and they were about a million people almost. Mm-hmm. So how they did that? They did it by just knowing how to divert the water from the stream up there into the taro fields and so forth, and to grow fish. And they had wonderful way of catching the fish and putting them in special walls and so forth, and in managing those aquaculture operation, which wasn't very high intensity like you're going to see today in many operations, the modern operations. So they had less diseases also. Now, we have, on the other hand, people who do offshore aquaculture and wants to do, you know, those kind of things. So we have all the extreme. And I think we should give everybody the opportunity to go into aquaculture and educate everybody on the aquaculture. But I look at the aquaponics now also as a way of community development. I think many people, and I mean, if you go up the coast, why not? You see all those homeless. I mean, your heart is bleeding. You know, it's like terrible. It didn't used to be like that. And I think if we're going to bring it into the community, we can develop really healthy community, get them interested, and every family in every community can start working with aquaponics. It's simple enough, and it will be very good activity. But we want to support any type of aquaculture possible as long as the aquaculture is sustainable. And you walk away and it collapses. That's not what we want. And it has to be responsible for the environment.
So, Benny, real quickly, there's a website that people can go to.
Right. It's aquaculturehub.org. And it's the first aquaculturehub.org. And it's the first website in aquaculture that is not just information. It's based on social networking.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Benny and Glenn, for joining us tonight. And we're going to have to probably have these guys back to talk more detail about this. And that's Benny Ron from Aquaculture Program and Glenn Martinez from Olamana Gardens.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Please join us next week when we talk about cold lasers for medical treatments.
If you missed any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. We always love hearing from you.
Our engineer is Lillian Song, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
And we'll see you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe. And now we're going to hand it back over to Beth Ann at Pledge Central.